Why are you here? Why didn't you go south?
What do you mean? I stammered.
You know why, but British citizens have been told to stay in Moscow.
I don't think you remained here just for reasons of safety, he said quietly.
I don't know. I felt there'd be something for me to do here.
For the revolution?
Well, yes.
He gazed at me, and I had an extraordinary sensation, as though it were the first time in my life that anyone had really looked at me. Later that night, I lay in bed and listened to the wind, an unsettling tune with no comfort in it. I sat up. There was someone at my door.
Who is it?
Slavkin, a tall, awkward figure silhouetted in the doorway.
It's me, comrade. You weren't sleeping, were you?
His voice gave way a little.
No.
He approached my bed. I did not move. My mouth was dry. He crouched beside me and spoke in a ponderous monotone. Comrade Freely, I have long thought you a very rational, intelligent woman. I have known your positive attitude to the revolution and to women's rights for some time, but when you told me your reasons for staying in Moscow, it struck me that you would see my situation clearly without sentiment. I hope I deduced this correctly. He gulped, audibly. In the half-light, I saw his Adam's apple leaping up and down in his throat. In order for me to work productively, certain physical comforts are occasionally necessary. For some time, I have been wanting urgently to visit you with the proposal that we might become intimate, so to speak, that in the light of the new world we are building, we might ourselves enjoy free, mutually satisfactory. He hesitated. For a moment, my mind whirled. Then I noticed that he was trembling, the hand clutching his knees, white-knuckled. I reached across and touched him. Suddenly we were together, and he was kissing my face and pushing up my nightdress, and we were both shaking with urgency, and I was only astonished that I had never felt his hands on my waist before, or touching my breasts. And he was hurrying, and pressed himself upon me, cried out, and a moment later fell still. The whole had taken perhaps 5 minutes. My heart was galloping. I could not quite understand what we had done. After a while, Nikita raised himself from me, stood up and straightened his clothes.
I greatly value and respect your honesty and your generosity, he said, serious as ever.
I sat up, flooded with shame. I covered myself with a sheet.
Oh, I see.
Well, good night then. I'm tired, he said, retreating.
A peaceful night.
When he was gone, I got out of bed, took off my nightdress and washed, staring at myself in the mirror. My shame evaporated, and I was filled with joy.
Shame?
No, no. Here in Soviet Russia, there was no place for shame. Here, men and women were equal. We were honest with each other, and we had no time for sentiment. I could hear my mother's poisonous tones.
I'm afraid you're not the type men like, dear.
Every cell in my body rejoiced that night. She was wrong, wrong, wrong.
The Civil War brought news of more horrors every day. In July, they reported that the Romanovs were killed.
The poor girls. The little boy. I didn't tell the old ladies.
I spent my evenings playing canasta with them, my ears pricked for the sound of the front door closing behind Slavkin. Then I excused myself and went to bed, waiting, shivering with excitement, under the covers for the door to open quietly and Nikita's long silhouette to approach. Afterwards, we would lie in my bed and drink Armenian brandy. Nikita would talk, imagining a new way of living. Together, we planned a commune, a place where a group of us could live together and be moulded and changed by communal living, its problems and its rewards, into real revolutionaries, people capable of building communism.
But the Korbelas, what would they think?
Well, The alternative is Prigg and his louts. They will be back any day now to give these rooms away. This way, we can choose suitable participants rather than have to take Prigg's people.
Nikita was not the only one to have this idea. Ideological communes were springing up all over Moscow. They were a rational response to the life we found ourselves living with such scarce resources and such high hopes.
So we invited Fyodor Kuzmin, a student friend of Pasha's, to join us, and Volodya, the yardman's son, when he returned from the army. Marina and Vera Gettler, neighbours and old family friends, agreed as well. Together, we wrote a manifesto. For the first time in my life, I felt that I was engaged in a mighty, vitally important task. I had never been so happy.
One evening, towards the end of August, Nikita and I heard a muted knocking and voices at the front door. We leant out of the window into the warm summer night. Two figures were waiting in the street. We could hardly make them out in the twilight.
"Who's there?" Nikita called quietly. "Good Lord, can that really be you, Nikita?" came a familiar voice. "Get down here at once, you dog. Open the door to us."
Pasha and Sonya Korbeliev had returned to Moscow. Outside Yalta, the Korbelievs had found a small villa to rent and had installed themselves safely.
"Oh, they're quite happy," Pasha said. "But Sonya and I decided to come back to do our bit for the revolution and all that."
The following day, Nikita drew me aside and said, without looking me in the eye, "We've always been friends, comrade. I hope you will do me the honour of remaining my friend, even if certain aspects, which were always quite separate from our friendship, are no longer appropriate to our relationship." Part of me had guessed immediately what he was about to say, but nonetheless I was silenced for a moment. I sat on the stairs. "The fact is that now Pasha and Sonya are here and all our members are about to move in, the time has come to devote ourselves to the commune. Do you see? We must all make sacrifices, and our physical intimacy is one of them. We cannot have couples with secrets and so on, forming divisions within the group. We must be a collective."
I said nothing, determined not to cry. To my horror, he crouched down in front of me and put his hands on my shoulders.
"I must tell you, Gertie, how grateful I am for your friendship. I've never known anyone like you. You have taught me so much about the human spirit, what generosity it is capable of. With you in the commune, I think we have a chance of making it work."
He gave me a little squeeze and left. Was it my imagination? Or was he almost jaunty as he stepped out of the front door?
I lay hunched over on the stairs for a long time, feeling the sharp edges of the mahogany panelling pressing into the skin of my forehead. Tears dripped onto the stair carpet, soaked in and disappeared. Then I heard someone coming and struggled upright, straightening my clothes. So, at the end of August 1918, the Korbeliev's house on Gargarinsky Lane became the Institute of Revolutionary Transformation. And we, its raw materials, aching to be transformed.
Episode 4. The day began in the IRT with the clanging of Mr. Korbeliev's huge copper gong, one of the few possessions of his that still remained in the house. At 6:30, we sat down to eat breakfast in the airy high-ceilinged dining room with its large windows giving onto the garden, and listened while one of the members read something suitable, Gorky, perhaps. A relief, as the food was best not dwelt on. It was usually kasha, buckwheat porridge, or perhaps blandinka, as we called millet porridge, with salt fish. Even in the summer, when supplies were relatively plentiful, there was already the sensation of dread before you'd started your bowl. The last spoonful was drawing near,
You took smaller and smaller bites, and you savoured the feeling of food on your tongue, in your mouth. You never swallowed too quickly. The only way to overcome hunger was to welcome it in. After we'd scraped our bowls clean, if it was not a working day, we sat in the garden and debated how to run the commune. The men's dormitory was Mr. Korbeliev's bedroom, while at first the female members of the commune had the small separate bedrooms at the back of the house. Then Dr. Marina disagreed with this arrangement. A motion was carried unanimously, and the following week the three back bedrooms were knocked into one. Sonia, Dr. Marina, Vera and I moved in together. "The children seem to be turning everything upside down, Miss Gertie," Anna Vladimirovna kept saying querulously. "In my day, father would have sent them to bed with no supper." "Well, that's more or less what happens these days too." "Nothing to worry about," Vera soothed them. Vera, who wasn't remotely interested in politics, was probably the most generous and selfless communard of all of us. She often helped me with the old ladies, who adored her. "Let's listen to the gramophone, shall we?" Dr. Marina and Vera had brought the gramophone with them, and in the evenings we danced on the lawn. Pasha asked his aunt to dance, and Nikita led out a shy and delighted mamselle. I hung back as each song ended, hating myself for minding that he never asked me. Towards the end of 1917, Slavkin had begun work on his first psychotechnological device, the propaganda machine. This was no more than a rusty upside-down grain hopper from the back stables bolted onto the Korbeliev's open carriage. To enter, one mounted the steps of the carriage and squeezed through a door cut in the side of the hopper. The benches had been removed, and instead there was a single large chair, heavily padded, with a footstool, while the curving wall in front was entirely covered by a white screen. The patient seated himself in the chair and was strapped in around the waist, legs and arms. A sizable helmet was lowered to restrict his viewing solely to the screen. Then the door was closed and the anti-bourgeois vaccination began. A series of short films and flashing images, accompanied by a soundtrack, played on a gramophone lodged at the top of the funnel. Meanwhile, canisters of different, powerful smells were discharged into the hopper. The temperature was raised by means of several gas lamps, and at certain moments in the session, the whole construction could be violently and unexpectedly pushed and joggled from the outside. We hoped that the combination of these effects would produce an indelible impression on the brain. Night after night, we pooled our ideas and experimented with the propaganda machine settings, the right images, the snatches of speech, the timing, searching for the touch paper to light people's hearts. One hot Friday in late August, I walked from the school to the Hotel National at the bottom of Terskaya. I climbed the grand Art Nouveau stairs to the office of Emil Pilyagin, a party official who, so the director at the language school had told me, wanted private English lessons. My first sight of him was of a round, startlingly white bald patch surrounded by black brilliantined hair. He was peering closely at a file in the centre of his desk, while on either side of him stood a tower of other books and papers. "Ah, Comrade Freely, very good. If you wouldn't just mind waiting while I finish a small piece of business off." I sat in the corner of his office while he called in his secretary. "Bring me those papers, comrade." His secretary, a tall, serious girl who looked somehow familiar, did as she was told. I waited for almost half an hour while Pelyagin worked through these papers. At last he waved the secretary out of the room and stood up. He was barely any taller on his feet than sitting down. I stood and sat down again quickly, embarrassed by my extra foot of height. At the end of the lesson, he said, "I've heard about your institution. And Slavkin, is that his name?" He stood up to dismiss me. "Perhaps you'll tell me all about it in our next lesson." I hurried straight from the National to meet Pasha at Nakompros, the Commissariat of Enlightenment, where he was working in the Department of Museums. Pasha and I had arranged to visit Smolensk Market together that evening.
All day I had been aware of this task ahead of me, a knot of apprehension in my stomach. The markets were periodically closed down by the Soviet in an attempt to control all the food distribution in the capital. But as most of Moscow's citizens received either a ration that would have killed them off within a couple of months or nothing at all, we were forced onto the black market. The traders swirled and eddied, regrouping in the suburbs and then creeping street by street back to the centre. Each time the Red Guards knocked them back more viciously. But even that didn't stop the traders. Pasha and I bought dried fish and rusks, millet and barley, and from a tall, well-built woman, even a couple of pounds of butter, half melted, so I bargained her down a little. "Take it, and good health to you," said the woman cheerfully. "I'll leave for home now, and you better hurry too. I've got a feeling those red bastards will be along soon." "Why's that?" She lowered her voice. "Old Crooked Legs over there's packing up and leaving, and he's..." She knocked her fist quietly on the palm of her other hand. I understood her. He was a stokach, an informer, who knocked on the police door. I felt it then, a ruffle, like a wind, from the other end of the market, shouting, "Comrades, beware!" I saw the guards pushing into the market, glints of their rifles, ripples of people panicking, crashing into each other. A child screams. We ran across the bare expanse of the square. I heard my breath loud in my ears, shouts behind me, then bang! A rifle shot. My knees buckled. For a moment I thought I'd been hit. Let's go," hissed Pasha in my ear. He hauled me up by the arm. "It's just a shock. You're all right." And we reached the side streets and dived into a courtyard, slid down the wall. Pasha was still holding me by the arm. "Oh, Gertie," he whispered after a moment, giving me a lopsided grin. "You are my one true love, even though you do fall over in the most inconvenient places." "Just stop, Pasha," I spat back at him, furious. I was shaking. I could hardly get my words out. "Why do you still have to talk like that? In the old days it was a joke that we all understood, but..."
"What?"
"Well, we're all trying to be honest now. Sincere." "Well, I suppose I must mean it then," he whispered, still smiling. "I love you, Miss Gertie, especially when you're telling me off." "It's so easy to mock the governess, isn't it?" Tears of rage pricked my eyes. "All your revolutionary ideas, and at the heart, you're just a snob, like your aunt." In the early days of the IRT, many of our evenings were spent listening to and discussing each member's piece on their revolutionary development. As we drank the hot water flavoured with the little grated carrot that we called tea, Sonia read us her account, describing the failure of her marriage. In 1915, she had married Petya, only to wave him off to war just a few months later. In 1916, he was badly wounded and lost a leg to septicemia. Throughout 1917, while he was ill, she devoted herself completely to him. But as he recovered, all her attempts to be a good wife were met by increasing hostility on his part and frustration on hers. I thought the marriage would probably have foundered even without the injury, but of course that didn't stop Sonia from feeling that she'd failed him at his most vulnerable.
"You did well," Nikita said.
Sonia looked up at him, and I saw that she was crying.
"No," she retorted, "I did not. That's what I mean. Now I must work hard and do well. All my life I've wasted time, squandered my privileges, but now..."
"Now you have changed. Forgive yourself." Pasha's account of his revolutionary development was really the story of his love affair with the avant-garde. I couldn't quite believe in Pasha's commitment to the revolution. His dandyism seemed to undermine it, above all his constant ironic commentary on life. Yet he was entirely serious about art and the theatre. He insisted on dragging us to the theatre several times a week. The futurist reviews always ended in commotion. I remember one evening at the Café Petariesk on Kunyetsky Bridge. Slavkin's lecture on the prop mash was followed by an act in which all the performers wore machine costumes made out of cardboard, 8 or 9 foot tall. They looked imposing, but their voices were inaudible. After a while, tired of listening to muffled and incomprehensible fragments of poetry, the audience began to shout and throw things at the tiny stage. The futurists threw off their cardboard tubes and a brawl ensued. Through the crowd, I suddenly caught sight of Emil Pilyagin. He looked out of place and panicky. I pushed my way through to him. "Comrade Pilyagin, what brings you here?" We had talked about the event, I remembered. Pilyagin was having 3 hours of lessons a week. I had become quite fond of him. He turned and smiled and immediately solemnized his face. "Comrade Freely," he said with a bow. "Well, as a government official, I try to keep myself abreast of developments in culture." I felt myself blushing ridiculously. "Well, it's very kind of you to come. Would you like to meet Slavkin, now you're here?"
"Certainly."
I forced my way over to Slavkin, but Pilyagin was stuck behind a group of boys who were rather the worse for alcohol. "Oh, Nikita, my pupil wants to meet you. Go and rescue him, won't you?" I gasped. Slavkin, a foot taller than anyone else, passed through the crowd with ease, occasionally lifting tussling boys out of the way. With an amiable smile, he arrived at Pilyagin's side. Slavkin put a hand on his shoulder to guide him through the melee. Pilyagin shook his hand off, a mulish look on his face. Then Slavkin took Pilyagin forcibly by the shoulders and propelled him across the room to me. I'm not sure his legs weren't lifted off the ground. Before I could say anything, Slavkin bundled Pilyagin out through the fire escape. I squeezed after them. Out on Terskaya Street, Pilyagin shook Slavkin off and brushed down his jacket. "Please forgive me, comrade, if I was mistaken," said Slavkin gravely. "Gertie asked me to come and help you. These days the kids do sometimes get carried away." Pilyagin cleared his throat. "There was no need to manhandle me." In the years since, I have probably wasted not just hours, but whole days wondering about this episode. And even so, I still can't work out if it had any bearing on the course of events. Episode 5. As the first thrill of the commune faded, tense moments seemed to arise between us more and more frequently. These were never, needless to say, about politics or morals, but usually over some idiotic detail. One evening, Fyodor accused Sonia of having eaten 100 grams of her bread ration on the way home, driving her to tears, at which Pasha swore at Fyodor so inventively that Fyodor threatened to move out. Another time Vera and I fell out over how long she took to do the ironing. These were nothing, however, compared to the incident between Dr. Marina and Volodya. There had never been much love between the two of them, but they were now both on their feet, shouting at each other. "Stop!" Slavkin was on his feet between the two of them. "Quiet! Now, let us try to understand. What are you saying, Doctor?" "She's talking about me, of course," Volodya interrupted, clearing his throat. He went over to Vera and took her hand. "Verochka and I, we are very happy to announce to you all that we are occasionally sleeping together, or rather, not sleeping, having sexual intercourse, seeing as you all seem to think it's your business." Aghast, I glanced towards Slavkin.
"But we've all promised Nikita to be celibate," I burst out. You mustn't, you know."
Nikita sat back in his chair as though all the energy had flowed out of him. "Vova," he said quietly, "you are perfectly within your rights, but, my dear friend, if you have affairs, not only will you spread disharmony among your fellow commune members, you will be distracted from your revolutionary work." There was a pause. "Come on, "We don't want to let you down," said Volodya at last, almost pleading. "Tell us what you want us to do." Slowly, with purpose, Nikita spoke. "I want you to promise that you will cease these sexual relations." I slipped out of the room and went to check on the old ladies in their bedroom. Mademoiselle was not well. She'd had a chest infection, and as I settled her for the night, I was aware of Anna Vladimirovna watching me. No detail ever passed her by.
"You're shaking, Miss Gertie," she said.
No, I'm a bit tired, that's all. I shall go straight to bed now." As I left the room, I heard her say in a loud, hoarse whisper,
"I've always said it doesn't do to let peasants have too much of a say. Now he's ruling over them all like a Tsar."
By the end of September, Slavkin's propaganda machine was finished, and we were spending several evenings a week administering anti-bourgeois vaccinations at a rate of 12 an hour. A photograph has survived of Nikita and Sonia standing together. Sonia is speaking, gesticulating with one hand and pushing her hair back with the other. Nikita is gazing at her, smiling a little. I feel I can remember this exact moment, that exact look. The propaganda machine was a triumph in all ways but one. Slavkin's great wish was to win government support for it. At the behest of his artist friends, Anatoly Lunacharsky, Pasha's boss at the Commissariat of Enlightenment, consented to a vaccination. When he finally emerged, he was smiling in a restrained way. He put on his hat and shook Slavkin's hand.
"Let me congratulate you on a very fine piece of circus," he said. "Such things are still important. And I hear that your work on iridium alloys is remarkable."
Slavkin was despondent for several weeks after Lunacharsky's snub. Once the whiff of entertainment had tainted the prop mash, he lost all interest in it. He was already turning to the latest ideas on particle physics and to Einstein's revelations. In the first frosty days of November 1918, Slavkin came to one of our evening meetings with a request. He produced a piece of paper and began to read from it.
"Tin sheeting, iron bars, copper wire, acid, these are some of the materials that I will need for my new project. If you could help me to assemble them, I assure you, you'll be performing a great service for the revolution."
We gazed at him without a word. It was a capital offence to steal firewood, let alone the things Slavkin was after.
"Is this for the socialisation capsule?" asked Sonia. "Yes, it's about the size of a bathtub. Rather a long one, with a lid. You lie down in it," replied Slavkin. "There's one more thing, too, that I need. Nothing we haven't managed to obtain before. Just a little iridium. With a shield of iridium, my capsule will withstand any pressure. It will be invincible."
The first anniversary of the October Revolution was to be celebrated with all the scale and pomp that the actual event had lacked. The Commissariat of Enlightenment planned a blaze of red flags, great crowds of singing schoolchildren, increased rations and free meals for the people, the hammer and sickle everywhere, and the face of Lenin against snowy roofs and buildings. An astonishing amount of money had been made available, and the organisers had been given the right to requisition scarce materials, as Slavkin had already discovered. On the day itself, the IRT and the propaganda machine took part in the Smolensk district procession. As the light faded, we arrived at the old Governor-General's mansion for the free meal provided for participants. I looked up and down the long tables, at people ruminating over their miserable food. Just like the soup kitchens in Tsarist times. It all felt a long way from any genuine progress.
"Come," said Slavkin, jumping up suddenly. "There's something I want to show you."
We followed him down a side street to a tiny church. The gold had been stripped off its domes. No light shone in the windows, but Slavkin led us to a side door and knocked three times, paused, and knocked three times more. The door opened, and Slavkin motioned us inside. The door swung shut behind us, leaving us in darkness. I breathed in incense and wax, smoke, old cloth. At last, I made out some shapes around me. I put my hand out and felt Nikita's sleeve. He took my arm and tucked it tightly under his, and we shuffled forwards until we were obviously in front of the altar. I looked around quickly. Sonia was somewhere behind, standing alone. A figure, a priest, one assumed, was moving about. The swish of his skirts and the occasional clink of one vessel against another suggested that he was performing the offices of the Mass. A shiver passed through me. By a faint glimmer of light from the window behind him, we watched him move about behind the altar, mouthing the words. He raised the host and after a moment signalled for us to kneel. Without a word, we did as we were told, one by one. Nikita and I sipped the watery wine, the first time I'd taken communion for years. Like me, he seemed to shudder with emotion as he swallowed. I was wildly happy. I squeezed Nikita's hand as we stood and retreated from the altar.
Batushka!
Beside me, his voice echoed out suddenly. Light a match, would you, Pasha? Father, we mean you no harm, but we must ask you to give us something. I know you, don't I? The priest approached, peering into Slavkin's face. You're the boy from Alexeyeva. As quickly as it had come, the happiness left me, and I felt queasy.
Yes, I've come to see you again with my friends this time, said Slavkin. We need something you have. Give it to us, and we'll not disturb you again.
What can I give you? I have nothing left.
I want the cup. Not that one. The other. The priest let out a feeble cry.
But this is the host. I cannot give it to you. A mortal sin.
Then we shall take it and spare you the sin, said Slavkin calmly. He stepped forward and removed the cup from the altar. Come, everyone. Let's go. The cup, as Slavkin knew, was another of those made of iridium. It had probably come from the same region of Siberia. On the way back, he was jubilant, hopping from foot to foot.
Now we can build the future. Don't you see?
In November 1918, Nikita, Pasha and I came home one evening to find Prig at the front door, hands on his hips.
Good evening, comrades, he said smoothly. As you know, due to the compression of living space throughout the capital, this house is due for resettlement.
Within days, a total of 42 people had arrived at the doors of Gagarinsky Lane, dragging cartloads of belongings and pouncing on every inch of space. We ended up with only 3 rooms between us. A metal worker and his family moved into the dining room. 7 of them. His children looked like 5 tiny old people, eyes shrunken in their yellow faces. Without consulting the others, Vera and I gave them dried apples and pickles from our stores. One evening, Sonia produced a telegram from Constantinople.
All aboard the Eloise sailing Marseille. Stop. Mama's health not good. Lack medicines and treatments here. Stop. Details on arrival. Stop. Korbilevs.
Since peace had been declared in Europe, we'd heard that hordes of refugees were leaving Russia for Turkey, France or New York. I hated to imagine their journey with an ill Mrs. Korbilev.
I would like to have the commune's agreement, broke out Sonia unexpectedly. I want to leave my job.
What would you do instead? Asked Fyodor. Slavkin spoke up.
I need a co-worker on the capsule. I'm making progress, but it will go faster. But we need your ration, Sonia, objected Fyodor. We can't feed ourselves as it is.
Yes, I know, she said. I thought I could make a trip to Mikhailovka. Some of the peasants are still well disposed towards our family, you know. I think they would help us.
Don't be a fool, Pasha exclaimed. It's much too dangerous. Please, no, Sonia.
I will do whatever the commune thinks best.
Sonia spoke up again, but I didn't come back from the south to waste my time.
If I succeed in the task I am now setting myself,
said Slavkin calmly. The revolution will, I promise you, make a huge leap forward. This, after all, is our chief aim, is it not?
But is Sonya really the best person to help you? I put in. She has little or no scientific education, and
she will do very well, Slavkin said, definitively. Sonya began work with Slavkin a day or so later, and with her he spent longer hours than ever closeted in his workshop. After making a careful inventory of our stores, we decided that in order to survive the winter we would have to go bagging, despite the fact that it was illegal. It meant setting out into the countryside with a bag slung over your shoulder and bartering with any peasants you might come across. Red guards who searched the trains not only confiscated any goods people might have collected, but quite often shot the bagman too. Pasha and Volodya volunteered to be the bagman. Later the same week, we accompanied them to the railway station, marching in formation and singing revolutionary songs. Verochka bathed Volodya's face with tears and made a surreptitious little sign of the cross over him. Pasha kissed his sister and made me a funny little bow. Each day, on my return from work, the quietness of the house was noticeable, the dampening of all our spirits. 1 week passed, and two, and three, without word from our bagmen.
History, a voice called my name, a melody so sweet, never feels the same. In the quiet moments, where the stars align, our souls dance together, crossing the divine. In the tapestry of time, our hearts are sewn. Every beat of promise, we're never alone. But I go trying
in the sands of time. Every trial, the horizon climb. Every sunset and every dawn's new blood. Inside together, I'll never let you go. Now we're together.
Yeah. Thank you.